KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Coming up this hour, our Green Days gardening panel, the originals, are here to answer your calls and questions about gardening. You can email now, weekday@kuow.org. Last week, the State Senate Majority Caucus announced it was ready to talk about transportation funding. It's only a few weeks after the legislative session ended. Everett Herald political reporter Jerry Kornfield joins me now. Jerry, long time no talk.
Hey, well, there hasn't been a lot to talk about, but just the sun is out and the meteor shower continues.
Oh, well, that's nice. Well, I guess it's sort of meteoric that the majority caucus, which is Republicans and a few Democrats, have finally decided it's time to talk about transportation.
Yeah, it seems that the issue they did not want to talk about at all for, 105 regular days, and then a special session, and then a second special session, is now appears to be on the front burner for them for 2014.
And why? What happened?
You know, I don't know if anything happened other than, the cynicism would say they never were going to do transportation because that was on their long-term plan. We'll use that as a tool to, you know, wedge other issues along, and then we'll deal with it later. I just think they wanted to put to rest the Columbia River Bridge crossing, that new bridge over I-5, at least as the way it is designed with light rail. They succeeded in getting that sidelined, and it appears to be dead, but hey, it's government, so maybe nothing's quite dead. And now they're ready to go out on their terms, have a conversation.
Well, as I understand it, there does seem to be some acknowledgement that they need to raise taxes. So they're holding a statewide series of hearings?
Right. They basically wrote a letter to the Secretary of Transportation saying, hey, let's wipe the slate clean and let's see what we've already done and then let's go forward. So they want to try to look over the past. They plan to go around the state. They have dates, but they don't have times and locations. Starting in mid-September till the end of October, they'll be in places like Tacoma, Seattle, Everett, asking the state as well as the community leaders to come in and say, what do you want to build? And then while you're sitting here, here's some of the reforms of what we do with state transportation dollars that we in the caucus want to see happen. What do you think of those ideas? And I think that their idea is, well, we'll hear about reform, we'll hear about revenue, and then we'll go write up a package that puts the two together. One thing that's different than the legislative session is the leadership is saying, we want to talk about some of these reforms. We want to have a good airing of changes for everything about from prevailing wage to how fast the permits are issued, but they, at least at the top, are saying it's not our way or the highway, if you will, proposal, that they're willing to bend on those reforms or maybe not force them through and still go forward with the package.
Reforms or terms of agreement, you might call them as well. What's the top of the reforms that they'd like to see?
Well, I'm not sure if they have a single number one. It seems to me that if they had their druthers, the first thing they want to do is they want to look at how projects are designed, how the permits are issued, and then how they're built, because they're concerned that the state over-designs the projects, and then they over-regulate, and then they take too long to build them. So if they can figure out a way to speed up these projects and cut the cost, that would be a big victory. The other part is accountability. They hold out a couple of those really high-profile, if you will, mistakes. Pontoons for the new Evergreen State Bridge, leaky, they got to be repaired. Some of the new ferries cost more and lean, and now they want to get, those kinds of issues they think are an embarrassment, and they want to make sure they don't happen again.
So just timeline, the fall will be the time, or early fall, when the hearings take place, and then they will propose this during the start of the first legislative session.
Yeah, there is one sort of Hail Mary opportunity in November, I think it's the 21st. Lawmakers, at least most of them, if not all of them, are expected back in Olympia for an annual day or two of hearings of all their different committees. They do this every year to kind of gear up for the next session. It's possible that if somehow a package was written and agreed to, they could have a special session and vote on it. But given that they want to deal with the reforms, I see that the best hope for this happening is in probably around March of 2014.
Well, you mentioned the state ferries, part of the transportation system, and a ferry that runs from Whidbey over to Port Townsend was seriously leaning, listing, or whatever the official term is.
Yeah, it's when it was in the water empty, there's three ferries. Each are 64-car ferries. They're all using the same design. When they're empty, they lean a little bit to the side because that's where the gas tank and the engine are put. It was designed that way. It was designed on purpose. It doesn't have a problem because the theory is that when it's loaded, it sits flat in the water. But it looked bad enough, and it concerned folks both who work for the ferry system and captain as well as the public, that they, on one boat, the Salish, they've added 72.5 tons of ballast, this steel shot. So now it sits flat in the water when it's empty. And it looks better and apparently runs a little smoother in the water and may even use up a little less gas. And so they have two more boats to do probably this fall, October and November. And so that'll take that off the complaint list, if you will.
Yeah, and they can just load them the way they load ferries that don't lean in the water.
Exactly. And, they're building new ferries, and that was the other part. The folks down in Olympia didn't want to build new ferries, and they're bigger ferries if they had concerns about the older ones.
That seems fair to me. We're talking with Jerry Cornfield of the Everett Herald. And Jerry, money is always an issue in the state. It doesn't matter if we're in good times or bad. And last week, the state released a list of schools that are going to get money to convert half-day kindergarten classes into full-day classes. But I guess at least one district in Snohomish County declined.
Yes, a situation they've seen coming for years. Mukilteo School District has been, unlike a lot of school districts, it has been growing, and its student population has been growing steadily, and over the last 5 years added over 500 students. But they haven't added any schools, and so what's happened is they've run out of space. They've added portables on campuses, and now they have elementary schools that are packed with portables and no room. And then when the state came and said, hey, if you take our money, you can have some all-day kindergarten, and they said, that requires classrooms. We don't have space. So they actually had to turn down money, $1.6 million over the next 2 years. And in 2014, they may go to voters and say, please pass a bond so we can build a new elementary school, and then we can have all these kindergartens in school all day. They've tried three times since 2006. Each time, the voters, a majority support it, but you need 60% to pass, and they never get that 60% margin.
Interesting. Well, money's going to also play a role in a statewide battle over Initiative 522, and Seattle readers and Everett readers got a look at what this is. This is a proposal that would label foods that have been genetically modified to be labeled that way so that consumers know what it is. And we're talking potentially tens of millions of dollars funneling into both sides of this campaign.
Yeah, just your basic run-of-the-mill statewide campaign. When in the recent past have we not had a multi-million dollar campaign over an initiative? That would be a remarkable thing if it didn't happen. And this battle went on in California last year, what was called Proposition 37, and they spent there. It's a bigger state, understandably, but there was a combined $55 million spent. So that's why everyone's expecting a lot here. The public is going to start to get more and more information, and it's going to be billed as a, do you want to know what's in your food? Versus, the cost of telling you what's in your food will probably scare you, make you nervous for no reason, and by the way, it'll increase the cost of that food you're buying. And I think that's where you're going to get this back-and-forth battle.
The food industry, I think when you talked about how much was spent in California, the vast majority of that came from the food industry who did not want to see the labeling.
Right, food industry and the industry that makes or works on sort of creating seeds. The Monsanto, for example, put in $8 million alone. Now, just remember, Costco put in $18 million to get a liquor privatization. So it's not unheard of for a company to just write a big check. But, they're doing research on seeds and genetically modified seed, taking one plant and tinkering with it so they can create another, maybe a longer lasting, more insect repellent kind of plant. So, you know, that's the kind of thing they're trying to do. Not to defend them, just to explain that's what their research are doing. But if they come up with something and they put it in a product, that now would have to have a label should voters pass this initiative. So you'll know, hey, this was includes product created by man, not by natural means.
We'll be following the initiative itself as the fall progresses. Thanks for taking a break from the sun, Jerry. Go put your SPF on and head back outside.
Hey, how'd you know?
Everett Herald political reporter Jerry Kornfield here on Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
KUOW 94.9 News and Information.
Hey, it's Luke Burbank. This week on LiveWire Radio, Howard Bloom discusses the first nanoseconds of the universe, music from Edna Vasquez, and Alex Falcone tries to tell a joke with a mouthful of peanut butter.
We spent like $200 on favor today, but is this an invite to tell people that the invite is coming later?
Wait, why did we think that was a good idea? All that and so much more coming up this week on LiveWire Radio.
Seattle's own Luke Burbank down there in Portland for LiveWire. You can hear it Saturday afternoon at 5 o'clock on KUOW2, our second program service.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor organic garden supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, fresh brewed compost tea daily, and Baker Creek seeds, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
67 degrees in Seattle with mostly blue skies. Today's high temperature in the upper 70s, close to 80, with that sunshine continuing all day here in the Seattle area. Tonight's low temperature in the upper 50s and partly cloudy.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Writer and historian Andrew Carroll calls wartime correspondence America's great forgotten literature. Carroll has collected 90,000 letters or so from soldiers who fought in every American conflict. He's published them in several volumes, and he's made it his goal to bring this material to the public eye. Now Andrew Carroll is using some of his vast collection to create an evening of theater. His one-act play is called If All the Sky Were Paper, and it has a staged reading tonight at Seattle Repertory Theater. Andrew Carroll's in the studios, and thank you so much for coming in.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You have some of these letters with you, but I wanted to talk about the first letter. This was a collecting career that seems like it started by accident.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I had no interest in history, no connection to the military whatsoever. I was a sophomore in college when my dad called and said, the house is on fire, and then actually it's gone. And it was just a random electrical thing. House was destroyed. And, you know, what affected me the most was losing all of our family memorabilia. Mm-hmm. That's what you just can't replace.
Right.
And a couple weeks later, a distant cousin of ours, Carol Jordan, called up and said, I heard about the fire. I'm so sorry. And, you know, I was just going through my old letters from the war. He was a veteran from World War II. And he sent me this letter that he had written in 1945. Mm-hmm. He had just walked through Buchenwald, the concentration camp, and he was writing back to his wife, Betty Ann, about what he saw. And he sent me the original letter, and I've got it here. It's this thin onion skin paper, and it's very graphic. I won't go into the details because it's pretty explicit. And I called him back. I said, this is so historic. Let me send it back to you. He said, no, just keep it. I probably would have thrown it out anyway.
Wow.
And over the next couple of years, I would talk to veterans, and so many of them said the same thing, that, you know, I've already tossed my letters, whether in Vietnam or Korea or whatever. And it just seemed like such a loss that I wrote to Dear Abby, who was doing a lot on veterans issues back then, and still does actually. And I said, I want to start a project to encourage Americans to at least save their war letters. And I would set up a little post office box. So if they wanted to send me a photocopy, we'd have a backup. And she ran the column. It was November 11th, 1998, and the floodgates just opened. Thousands upon thousands of letters started pouring in from around the country. And that's how it all began.
It's really fascinating to me because I was thinking about Ken Burns' film, The Civil War, in thinking about you. And a lot of that documentary is based on Civil War correspondence from the time that people could write. I'm assuming during the Peloponnesian Wars that people probably sent some sort of missives back and forth across the Aegean Sea.
It's funny you mention that because there's a book that came out of Roman letters when they were stationed, well, it's now Great Britain.
Right.
And they were complaining about the same thing that soldiers, there was like no beer, they didn't like their commanding officers. It's sort of timeless. But our focus is just on American correspondence.
Right.
And we have letters from every war in our history, going back to the Revolution and the Civil War. And it really was actually, because this was happening about the same time as the fire, the Ken Burns documentary had a huge impact on me. And there's that famous Sullivan Blue letter that mm-hmm. he wrote to his wife in case he was killed, beautifully written. And I just turned to a friend. I was like, someone should like really work to preserve these. And she's like, well, why don't you do it? And again, I'm like, I have no background in this. But it's become a labor of love. We're still looking. And in fact, what we just announced recently is that Chapman University in California is going to be the recipient of this collection, and we're going to change the name from the Legacy Project, which is what I've been calling it, to the Center for American War Letters. And I am just hell-bent on making this the largest collection of war letters in the world.
So it will be an official archive housed in a university?
With real staff, not some guy with a storage facility in Washington. It'll be legitimate. And Chapman has really stepped forward. They are, you know, giving us staff, giving us a building, and they're really helping this play go around the country. And the play is based. I went to 40 nations to seek out foreign letters because so many American veterans had said to me, you know, you've got all these American correspondences, but you need to look at the full context of war. What were the British going through? What were the Russians going through? And I thought that would be just sort of fascinating. So I did this trip around the world that took me to Iraq and Afghanistan and all these different countries. And I wrote about it in National Geographic. And John Bennett, who's a theater professor at Chapman, read the article and said, this could be a play.
Now, you have compiled your letters. They've been the basis for PBS documentaries. But I don't know. Do you have drama in your background somewhere?
No. I mean, in high school, I dabbled a little bit in theater, but I wasn't a theater guy.
Like you weren't a historian.
Yeah, I really just stumbled into all of this. And it's the letters that speak for themselves. You know, we have a letter written by a young man who's in a ship at Pearl Harbor as the bombs are falling. You know, you look at the upper right-hand corner, it's chilling. It says December 7, 1941, USS New Orleans. Mm. We have letters by former slaves and war nurses. And those are really the voices that I want to hear because they're so often overlooked in history.
So this is a one-act play. It's not just a dramatization of what people have written, is it?
What we did is we've done readings of the letters before. We've had, you know, Senator McCain and Supreme Court justices and members of the media do readings at the Library of Congress and so forth. And those were really special and wonderful. But to do a play, we realized it needed a narrative arc. And so we tried to blend in kind of my journey to these various places. Because when I started out, everyone said to me, this is when the wars are going on. This is back in 2004. You're an American. People are not going to help you. That you're going to meet resistance and maybe even hostility in the countries you go to. When you go to Russia or Vietnam or Iraq, don't expect people to step forward to really want to, you know, assist you in this journey. And that's sort of what the dramatic tension is in the play of how do you even get these letters?
Well, how did you get these letters?
What it turned out was I don't want to give too much away because it's sort of the culmination, but I was the recipient of extraordinary generosity everywhere I went, and that had a huge impact on me, and that's part of the personal journey too.
So you're part of the play and there's other characters.
The real focus of the play are the letters. So it's sort of this is, you know, as I'm in Iraq and then I get this letter by a young Iraqi.
So you're
girl,
the frame.
Just to give it some kind of dramatic arc, exactly.
Why is it called If All the Sky Were Paper?
It's based on a really beautiful and poetic line from a 14-year-old Polish boy who was in a concentration camp, and he smuggled out a letter that eventually, years after the war, made it to his parents. He didn't survive. And he was trying to convey the suffering that they were going through. And so there's more to the line, which is kind of a high point, not a high point, but it is kind of one of the central parts of the play. It comes near the end. And it gets to this issue that even troops and veterans can't fully capture the horror of war. It's just too big and too enormous.
I don't know how many letters you have. You've brought in a portfolio and you've got individual letters and in sleeves, you know, the kind, if you're listening, that
protect the,
just to keep them safe. Are these the ones that are dearest to your heart, or are these the ones that are in the play?
A few of them are in the play. I brought these actually to show the cast members because I wanted them to get a sense of what they're a part of and that they're helping us spread the word. And it's funny because we've even the Seattle Times wonderfully did a front page story on this yesterday, and we're even now getting people saying, I've got letters I want to share
really?
With you.
Really? Still getting letters?
No, and that's the – if anything, this to me is like our rebirth. Like I want to just, you know – work as hard as possible to get more letters coming in, especially from Iraq and Afghanistan. We don't have as much from those conflicts. But just to give you one example, this is not in the play, but it was really one of the earliest letters I received that gave me a sense of, wow, I think we're on to something. It was written in, it's not unlike my cousin's letter. It was written in 1945. This young staff sergeant, Horace Evers, was in Munich with his unit, and they were sort of hunting down the Nazi high command at the end of the war. They walk into this one incredibly lavishly furnished apartment, and they realize this is Hitler's private Munich residence. Now, Hitler just killed himself in Berlin 3 days earlier, but this is where he lived in Munich. And so Evers went up to Hitler's desk, and there is the actual stationery, you know, his personal stationery that has the, you know, gold embossed and everything. And if Evers had written anything on the stationery, it would have been significant because of, you know, the value of the paper. He wrote about Dachau. So here on Hitler's own private personal stock, he is writing about the horrors that he's seen. And these letters serve as eyewitnesses to what these troops encountered. And because they're written at the time, they have a freshness and a vitality. And I think, you know, I'm all for oral histories. I think those are very important. Mm-hmm. And interviewing veterans years, decades sure. later. And I think they complement each other well because there's some things that they can't say in letters because of censorship. But the letters are just so spontaneous and really you feel the emotion of what they're going through. And that to me is the strength of the play. And it's not just we focus on so much the darker side, which of course is intrinsic to warfare, but some of the letters are very funny, and this is sort of how troops cope. And so whether sure. it's from the Persian Gulf War or, you know, from Vietnam, some of the letters really are very very amusing.
You mentioned that you don't have a lot of Iraq and Afghanistan letters, and I wonder now in the days of Skype and cell phones that you know the fact that you can just reach out and see your loved one means that soldiers aren't writing home as much.
And I fully understand the troops who say to me, listen, I want to see my children.
Sure.
They want to see me. I want to see my wife. Or in the case where now it's the wife who's going off to
right.
fight and it's the husband who's on the home
right.
front. So I get that. Fortunately, troops are still writing emails, and we collect those too. Those to me, as long as it's something written by the service members or their families, and we definitely focus on the home front, they get overlooked way too often. So we are getting letters from the current conflicts. But, I mean, we have tens of thousands of letters from World War II, and I would say probably just thousands from the more current conflicts.
So this is the first time, the stage reading tonight, as I understand it, is the first time that it's somebody who's an actor as opposed to a student actor who's going to be performing this.
This script. Is really our national premiere, and it's a new script too. We did something with Chapman some time ago, and that's, again, how I got connected with the community and fell in love with it. And the students were very respectful of the material, and I really I felt like this could be the home for this project. This is our first performance with professional actors, and it's really to kick off. We're going to be doing more performances across the country. The National Endowment for the Arts very graciously gave us a bit of a grant to help with this, and Chapman's underwriting it. And so this to me is a very special night at 7 o'clock at Seattle Rep because it is our first national premiere,
and it's free.
And it is free. Yes,
we
thanks
should
to
say
the
that part,
yes,
the free
absolutely.
Part. Well, so you've mentioned that this is sort of a rebirth of the Legacy Project with a new name. 15, am I right?
Years.
About 15 years after
yep.
the thing, but you also have a sort of parallel project that you've been doing called Here Is Where, and you're sort of you can go to your website and see places that you've been where that maybe signify moments in history. So this whole idea of bringing history into the contemporary eye is
and
now
forgotten history.
Forgotten.
That's really the, and I'm calling this the Forgotten History Tour, which is a little cheesy, but it's what, you know, I figured I have to name it something. And it's interesting because the book I did, Here's Where, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History, came out in May. And my first stop was Seattle
mm-hmm.
because there was a wonderful teacher named Allison Agnew who was using the Here's Where idea with her students to get them to go out and seek. And the whole point of the book is to find unmarked historic sites across America. And so it's where, you know, inventors had their brainstorms and their epiphanies, or, you know, there's a prison in North Carolina where one of the inmates created the N1 carbine, and the warden actually gave him his approval to do it. And, you know, Philo Farnsworth, the 14-year-old farm boy who invented television. So I found his apartment in Los Angeles where he did the first experiments. So really these overlooked Americans and individuals, and the projects are very similar in that they are both about discovering what's sort of been hidden away. And so in attics across America are these great war letters. And I hope people will be inspired to go through their attics and or their basements and be like, hey, we've got letters we want to share with you too.
We are history is what you're saying.
We absolutely. And again, I am so empathetic of those who are like, look, history's not my thing. I was the same way. I had no interest in it growing up. But once it becomes human, and that's what the letters do, is it's not about memorizing events, places, and dates. It's here's one man or one war nurse's experience. And it just brings it to life in a way that I think nothing else does.
Andrew Carroll's one-act play, If All the Sky Were Paper, has its real official premiere, a stage reading tonight at 7 at Seattle Repertory Theater at Seattle Center. Again, tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Walton Studio Theater in Bellingham. Both events are free. Thank you so much for coming in, Andrew.
Thank you so much.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 10:32, KUOW 94.9 News and Information. I'm Jack Walters. Good morning.
Dorm rooms and bunk beds, communal bathrooms, oh no thank you. It's tanning beds and indoor theaters for these college kids.
The increased building of these upscale communities surrounding college campuses sort of falls in with the trend of what some people have called the country clubization of college.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Student housing goes upscale next time on Marketplace. It's from APM.
You can hear that tonight at 6:30 as part of KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 2 o'clock to 8 o'clock.
Did you know you can name KUOW as a beneficiary in your insurance policy or individual retirement account, and you might be eligible for additional financial benefits? The next time you review your long-term financial plans, consider including KUOW. For more information, go to kuow.org/future.
68 degrees in Seattle. Today's high around 78, mostly sunshine this afternoon. Tonight's low in the upper 50s, partly cloudy skies, and Wednesday a high close to 80, mostly cloudy conditions on Wednesday in the Seattle area.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. And dear listeners, if you haven't yet heard our news, starting September 3rd, Weekday and The Conversation are merging forces. We're creating a daily 2-hour show. We're calling it The Record from noon to 2. It's going to be co-hosted by Steve Scher, Ross Reynolds, and me. And Weekday lead producer Katie Sewell joins me now.
Hello.
It's nice to have you in here. It's time for a start after 20 years of Weekday. Amazing.
20 years of Weekday. This is actually the 20th anniversary month. And so this is our last week of Weekday being live. And then we're going to delve into 20 years worth of archive history. Picked out some oldies and goodies and some newer ones and some of the more dramatic things we've done during the years.
You want to give anybody any little hints?
No.
Just
I
listen.
Feel like I, you know, just tune in and be surprised. There's going to be lots of gems there. And so we're kind of going to celebrate Weekday as it ends after 20 years and then look forward to the new project with you and Steve and Ross working together. It's a little sad, you know, for me, I worked on this show for 9 years. So
a long time.
That's a pretty almost half of its run. But
it's sad for you because you won't be part of the new endeavor.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to help for a couple weeks. But yes, then me and my husband are moving to Rome for the year.
And we're feeling very sad about that. But,
yeah.
You know, a field trip in the work.
I know.
Weekday live from Rome.
Yeah, maybe so. And I'm going to still be working on projects. So if anybody wants to keep in touch with whatever I'm up to over there, who knows what it will be. You can email me at radiokatie@gmail.com and I'll be there.
And it's KATY.
Yes.
There's no IE in Katie's name.
Yep. And I'm going to hang around for a couple weeks to see this new show launch because I'm looking forward to seeing what happens too. So,
well, we're looking forward to it. It's called The Record, and you will hear at 9 in the morning starting September 3rd, The Takeaway with John Hockenberry, followed by a show that none of us has heard called Here and Now, a new show that NPR has launched. And then we'll be here at noon.
Yeah, you can't say that this fall is going to be boring.
Nope.
That's for sure.
A time of change. Well, Katie, I'm glad that you're around for a little while. We need someone to hold our hands.
That's right.
And so listeners, as you just heard, things are changing. And so this today is the last live gardening segment that you will hear on weekday. In the new configuration, there will be gardening and there will be our Green Days panel, but not in the same way that you've known and loved. So here's the phone number, 206-543-KUOW, 206-543-5869. And to help sort of kick off everything today, in the studio with me, Marty Winget, garden and travel writer par excellence. And you're the only face that I see today.
This is a rather empty table
yes,
today.
Yes, it is. Joining us by the miracle of technology from Portland, a voice we haven't heard in a little while, Willie Galloway, the author of Grow, Cook, Eat, host of the cooking and gardening website Digging Food. Willie, how are you?
I'm good. Hello. It's nice to be on.
It is really nice to hear your voice. And I'm assuming that since our gardens are just going nuts up here, that yours is doing well in Portland.
Yeah, it's doing pretty well. I had a baby on June 20th, so my garden's
so
a little diminished.
She's been busy with other things.
Oh, congratulations. And the name of the baby?
His name's Grady.
Grady. Well, I'm sure he'll be out helping you next summer.
Yeah, he likes to, you know, hang out with me in his little pouch while I water.
Pouch is good. Don't worry, you'll have time next summer. And by telephone from the beautiful San Juan Islands, I think Greg Rayburn, co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk and Vashon Basin Steward, gives up a moment of vacation to be with us. Hi, Greg.
Hey, I wouldn't miss it.
Well, we're happy to have you. I'm going to cough 1 second. and we're going to just jump right into questions because this may be your last time. I just have to ask, Greg, is it sunny up there so Marty and I can be jealous?
Oh, it is absolutely beautiful.
But it's beautiful here, too.
It's beautiful here. It's hard to tell, Marty. We're inside little cinder block
studio. I was just outside.
You were outside.
I could see it.
So, listeners, you know that you have a lot of gardening to do. And we go right to Flo in Lake Taps, who emails, do you guys know if there's any current research on the best thing to do for mildew or whatever it is that we get every year on squash leaves? I never water on top, but I get it anyhow on my community garden zucchini plants.
Perhaps you should water on top.
Is that it? Water it off?
Willie?
Well, it happens in actually drier conditions, and so that's why it usually happens in August. Really, the best way to prevent powdery mildew is to choose a variety that's resistant to it. So when you're researching varieties that you want to grow for squash next year, really take a close look at the variety descriptions in the seed catalog and choose a variety that is going to be resistant to getting the disease.
And remember that resistant...
There is some current research happening about actually using milk proteins as an organic spray. There's also... you know, a common advice is to mix some baking soda with water and spray it on the leaves to change the pH. I'm not sure how effective that is, though, you know, if it is something you wanted to try. I think it's usually, it's a tablespoon to a gallon, if I recall. I can't quite remember, but you could look that up online. So yeah, that's definitely of interest to organic farmers. So there is ongoing research and a kind of a hint if you ever want to look up what research is. If you Google, you know, organic powdery mildew and then cooperative extension, that'll usually pull up any sort of research that's going on at the land-grant universities.
Now, I should turn my mic back on. Marty, you last week told a listener that water will work in some instances.
I certainly advise it on things like roses. If you spray down your roses early in the morning on a day that a nice warm, sunny day where the water will dry off during the day, you can actually wash some of the spores off. But I just wanted to say that, you know, when we look to choosing resistant cultivars of something, we have to remember that resistant means they don't want to get it, but they might very well anyway.
So it's not foolproof is what you're saying.
No, not foolproof.
Our phone number is toll-free, 1-800-289-5869, 1-800-289-KUOW, or 206-543-5869. Marty Winget's in the studio. Willie Galloway, I think, is in a studio right in Portland, but joining us by technology, the ISDN phone line, and Greg Rayburn, they're enjoying the sunshine up in the San Juan Islands. Mary says, my fennel plants are head high and blooming, yet when I pulled one up, there was no discernible bulb. And am I rushing the harvest, or is there something wrong with my plants? They've begun to bend over, and they look ready.
Well, there's two types of fennel. There's bronze fennel, which never gets a bulb. And then there's Florence fennel, which does get a bulb. But if it's head high, the bulb is long gone. If you're growing Florence fennel,
Are you there?
You can go ahead and cut down the blossoms. You can use those in salad and the greens, but you will not be able to get a bulb, so you'd want to replant. It grows great in fall.
Okay. Replant it in fall, Mary. We're going to go to the phones, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Willie Galloway's in Portland, Marty Winget in Seattle, Greg Rayburn in the San Juan Islands. So if you recognize him, you can just ambush him and ask your question in person, I guess. Tisha in North Seattle, you have some cedar tree problems.
Yes, I have a couple of cedar trees. I think they're cedars. There's a lot of browning on the inside leaves. The ends, the tips of the branches are green, and there's a lot of green still on there, but a whole lot of brown leaves, bronze.
That sounds like the normal cedar they can call flagging, where evergreens do lose their leaves. It's just they don't tend to lose them all at once in the fall. So that, as long as the new growth at the end of the branches is still green and the tree looks healthy, I think it's fine.
Oh, great, great. It seemed like it was more than I'd noticed in the past, and I wasn't sure if it was maybe because we've had such a hot summer, but that's good to know that it's not abnormal.
It's not abnormal. So just enjoy it, Tisha, and thanks for your call, and rain will come back. I mean, that's one thing.
October, will we? Could we put it off till October?
I'd be perfectly happy about that. Our phone number, 543-5869, Rachel in Seattle's Bryant neighborhood. You're on the air next.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have a question about three plants that I have, Lithodora, heather, and wandering phlox. I inherited the heather when I moved into my house 5 years ago, and then I've had the Lithodora and the phlox for a couple years, and then I since learned that after they flower, I should aggressively prune them down to avoid getting all this woody, dead-looking plant underneath. I didn't do that, and so now I'm wondering where to take it from here. So what to do now, since I have this heather with green on top and then this woody, ugly, dead-looking material underneath, and that's true for all three of those plants.
Is the heather, does it bloom in summer or in winter?
It blooms in the summer.
Okay. So I think probably sometime over, somebody, a heather expert could answer this better than I could, but I would shear it back. I have seen heather sprout green from old wood. It's not as full and pretty, and I don't think it's something that you can cut back into that gnarly old wood very easily.
Really?
Lithodora, I just don't know how you could kill Lithodora. I happen to plant one. Anybody looking for a ground cover that will cover the ground? Buy Lithodora. It's coming up everywhere. It comes up in the middle of my ceanothus. It comes up in the middle of a hebe.
So she can just chop it, and it will come back.
Well, that's what I try to do to mine, and it just keeps coming back and blooming.
Okay, Rachel, so
if I chop it down to the woody stuff?
Well, let's not go crazy. Or you could do half. How's that? You could do a test.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Do some of the plant halfway back and then a few branches back really far and see what happens.
Okay?
And should I do that? When should I do that? What time of year?
So like I said, I can't kill this Lithodora. I do it all the time. I would I would do it in late winter, early spring, just to be on the safe side.
Okay.
All right. Good luck with that, Rachel. Thanks for your call. We're talking to this is the last live gathering of the troops. We have virtual gathering of the troops. Greg Rayburn, it's very virtual today. Greg Rayburn is in the San Juan Islands. He's co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk and the Vashon Basin Steward. by ISDN phone line from Portland, Oregon, Willie Galloway, the author of Grow, Cook, Eat, and New Mother. She's also in When She's Not Distracted by Babies, is a wonderful gardener and cook. And in the studio with us, garden and travel writer par excellence, Marty Wingett. And Angela and Ballard says, in regards to powdery mildew on my zucchini, I sprayed twice in the last 2 weeks with a mix of 32 ounces of water and 1/4 tablespoons each of baking soda, vegetable oil, and Castile soap, Dr. Bronner's. I've cut off the bad-looking leaves, and new growth is coming in dark, green, and healthy. I hope it lasts. So that sounds as good as anything. None of those is particularly harmful, are they?
No, and the oil and the soap act as surfactants to help the mixture stay on the leaves.
Oh, so that's why the oil is in that mix?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. We have a lot of callers that we're going to try to get to as many of you as possible. And we are now traveling to Seattle's Maple Leaf neighborhood. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question is about rugosa roses. And you know how they like to travel? And I need to keep the suckers from invading part of the garden. So the question is, how deep of a barrier, like bamboo barrier, how deep do I have to go to restrain those runners?
Well, the suckers on my rugosa, I have one called Scabrosa in the parking strip. It's a single magenta flower. I swear you can smell those flowers 10 feet away. They're so fabulous. Those suckers seem to go down no more than 3 or 4 inches. It could be because it's really poor soil. I don't know. And I also find them very easy to yank up. If I see one coming up in the middle of something, I can loosen it there and just pull. Mm-hmm. And then I pull it back as far as I want and cut it off. So that's, now some may say I don't control it very well, but that's the way I control mine. It's certainly a plant I wouldn't want to get rid of. It's fabulous.
Oh, yeah, it's too good to get rid of. But actual just vigilance and yank them out as soon as they show up.
Yes, and if you have friends that say, ooh, what a fabulous rose that is, you can always just plunge a shovel into the soil around a runner and pot it up and give it away.
Okay. So the whole runner has roots along?
Yes, it certainly should, and you'll be able to see that when you yank it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Excellent.
Thanks for your call, Jennifer. Our Green Days Gardening panel is here, and we go to Vern in Linwood now. Hi, Vern.
Hi. I live in Snohomish County, Linwood more or less, and we have a 1/4-acre lot. We have lots of native plants and others, lots of salal ferns, Oregon grape, rhododendrons, and 30 or 40 large second-growth Douglas firs. So we have lots of needles and cones. We use the needles as mulch, but what about the cones? Should we put them in yard waste, or are they the richest part of the compost? I know for many plants we eat the seeds, corn, peas, beans, nuts. So I've been wondering, maybe I'm throwing away the best part of our yard waste.
Interesting question. Greg?
Yeah, it seems like, the thing about the cones is they are particularly slow to break down. So they are pretty woody, so they can take quite a while. One thing you could do to speed that process up if you wanted to compost them would be to run them through a chipper shredder, if you have one of those. Otherwise, I have mulched, especially in the native plant area, I just scatter the cones around underneath the plant. So if I have a grassy area, back when I used to have lawn, I would move the pine cones and just get them back underneath the native plants where they could just break down and they're also out of sight.
Thanks. Does that make sense, Vern?
That sounds great.
Okay, thanks for your call, and good luck with that. I think, Willie, this question's for you. Diane writes, I have tiny garlic bulbs because I don't think I prepared my soil well enough. Can I use those tiny little plants to replant with prepared soil for next year, or should I get new garlic starts? And someone told me to plant in November, is that right?
So I would get new ones because typically when you, the bigger the clove that you plant, the bigger the head you get the next year. November is a fine time to plant, October or November. Garlic has really shallow roots, and it's been so dry for so long, and we had such a dry winter that I would guess that the reason her bulbs, part of the reason why, is that they may have not gotten enough water. Because they, you know, if you, when you pull up garlic, the roots aren't very long. And then they do typically do best with some supplemental feeding or really pretty well-prepared soil. So that's what I would suggest for next year. So she can eat those little ones, even though they're kind of annoying to peel.
They are hard.
Yeah. And start with buy some garlic at the farmer's market this fall and plant the biggest cloves from each head.
Thanks for that. In Mount Baker, Lauren has been holding. Hi, Lauren.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. So glad to be on the show. My husband and I just bought a home with an epic garden, and I unfortunately am not an epic gardener. It has some amazing 50-year-old fruit trees, including an apricot, an apple, a cherry, pear tree. There's also a peach tree that's almost dying. And the only one that's fruiting currently is the pear. So I was just wondering what I can do to revive my mini orchard.
Well, if the fruit trees have just been kind of left on their own for quite a while. I'm not. They can often become, the branches become really dense, and some new pruning actually will help reinvigorate and improve the fruiting of the trees. So getting some of those. Depending on what species of tree, getting the pruning bulletins from like WSU Cooperative Extension or taking a class in pruning your fruit trees is a great way to rejuvenate those trees.
You can look online. Plant Amnesty offers lots of pruning classes and also City Fruit. So if you look at cityfruit.org, you'll find lots of information.
And do they also offer pruning services, or is this something that...
Plant Amnesty will refer you to an arborist who could do fruit trees.
So that's the start, Lauren. Good luck with that. I have a question about peach trees in Seattle. Mm-hmm. I had heard that this is not their favorite place to grow.
Well, there are selections that are supposed to be good for cooler climates, but really, they do them so well in Yakima. Why don't we just buy them from the east side of the mountains? It's hard to grow a really tasty fruit.
There have been
each year.
You know, one of the challenges with the peaches are peach leaf curl. And I went over to a Vashon gardener who's growing peaches over to their house, and they've actually built a shelter over their peach tree.
Wow.
And they keep that shelter, they keep the peach tree covered from September through June and water underneath it. And then they remove the top during the summer months. And it has eliminated peach leaf curl on their tree.
And they must really like peaches, Greg.
Yeah, that's some determination. Vashon Fruit Club has some serious gardeners.
Anecdotally, we have a crabapple tree I just discovered in our house, and it's always, I thought it was dying. We're just renting, but then we moved our chicken coop over kind of the drip zone area of the tree, and it totally bounced back this year. It didn't have any disease on its leaves, which it's had in the past, and it got fruit for the first time. So, anecdotally, that if you, some chicken manure might be a good fertilizer for fruit trees. I don't know.
Well, it sounds like it worked for you, Willie. We're going to Joanne next in Lake Forest Park. You're on the air, Joanne.
Hi there. I have a fig tree that's in a large pot. It's only about 3 or 4 feet tall, and it was doing lovely, and then it started to get brown spots on a few of the leaves, and one of them turned yellow and brown and is starting to curl up. I'm very sad. What can I do to help this little fig tree?
Well, I guess the first thing to look at is the container it's in and the soil level and how often you water. And how damp the soil stays. So it's really easy for containers to dry out in this kind of weather. And we may go out to the garden and water what we think is often, but the containers can dry out every day. You don't want to overwater, but you don't want to underwater either.
So how is this the same thing where you stick your finger
in
and measure?
Don't be afraid of that soil. Dig around, stick your finger in, and see if it's damp or wet or dry as a bone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
I've been watering it every couple of days, typically.
Yeah,
It's been hot. So.
Check first.
So you think it's mainly
That's
soil?
That's the easiest thing to check. That is a common problem. And so after that, you might want to look at its exposure. It's in full sun.
It is.
Yeah. So I would look at the soil first.
And when's a good time to plant that into the ground?
Greg, when's your favorite time to plant?
Wait, what'd you say, Greg?
November. Once the rains return and things have cooled down, you get it in November, and then its roots can recover throughout the winter, and then that way it's able to withstand next summer's drought.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Joanne. Bye-bye. And a last email from Misty. The leaves of my Italian plum tree have splotchy black stuff on them, and they appear slightly wilty. There's a lot of fruit, still very green and hard. The tree's never had this stuff on the leaves before. What do I do?
Sounds like it could be sooty mold. If there were aphids in the tree, the mold grows where the aphid droppings land. And so you encourage beneficial insects. I mean, at this point, if the fruit is maturing, then I don't see that you can do very much.
So you just leave the plums should ripen. This isn't going to affect the fruit.
No, not those Italian plums. They are tough.
And plentiful, at least in other people's yards, not in my own. I want to take this minute or so to thank the three of you for the years that you have been together, both in person and Willie, ever since you moved to Portland. The fact that you've been willing to join us as well, our listeners have appreciated it. And I know I have, and Steve has, and all the crew at Weekday. So we thank you. Gardening will be here in the new show, The Record, that premieres on September 3rd. We're not sure yet what form it will take, but never fear. And for the present, you can reach our Green Days Gardening panel on Facebook, where they remain Green Days on, it's on KUOW, right? Or is it on Weekday? Green Days on
KUOW
Green Days.
There it is. And you just heard the voice of Willie, who I haven't talked to in a while, author of Grow, Cook, Eat, host of the cooking and gardening website Diggin' Food, which you probably don't have time to keep up much because you're keeping up a baby. So enjoy him. Greg Rayburn, co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk and Vashon Basin Steward. Enjoy the rest of your vacation, and thanks for taking time to be with us today and all your days. And Marty Wingate, garden and travel writer par excellence. You find her at martywingate.com. Thank you for coming in
Thanks
today.
Thanks a lot.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Alsadi. I'm Marcy Silman. Jack Walters is at the helm. We'll be back live tomorrow and talking the usual Wednesday gang. Robert Horton, Les Lane in for Vaughn Palmer, and John Talton, I believe, here on Weekday.
It's 10:59, KUOW 94.9. Austin, Texas has been in a drought for the last 5 years. Now the city is looking at using drought-resistant plants that work better with that area's rocky terrain. Details today at 1:30.
Join KUOW for Bumbershoot, featuring 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend, with artists of all genres from the band Fun to 60s rock with the Zombies. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Sound Theater Company, presenting The Wild Party, a musical by Andrew Lippa based on a banned poem about a troupe of thrill-seeking burlesque performers in the...
Thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.